Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. Wouldn't it be great if whenever you had a major relationship issue, you could end it and cash in on it? Doesn't that sound wonderful? Well, here's the thing. You can do that. All that needs to be ignored is your humanity, and all that needs to be avoided is prison. Killing your spouse can be quite liberating and lucrative, especially if you kill multiple spouses over a lifetime. You can make a living of it. In fact, there just needs to be the right amount of thought put in and preparation. A little luck always helps, and the right opportunity. Preparation meeting opportunity is said to be the formula of luck, though there is an additional ingredient that almost always makes fortune privilege. Being a big, handsome cop trying to get away with this in the 80s should have been a massive advantage for John Earl Bowman, but he blew it, and I can't for the life of me understand how. He had it all. No conscience, privilege, time. He just wasn't that imaginative, I suppose, which was fine for podunk America, but wouldn't fly overseas. John Bowman was known to his cop and military buddies as Bottles, and was later compared to Edmund Kemper. They shared a similar aesthetic with those thick Coke bottle glasses, outfits that looked to have been put on them by mother, a little boy haircut, the disarming aw shucks attitude, and, of course, the hulking frame. But despite the many similarities, including the pursued law enforcement career while being a stone-cold killer, Bottles couldn't hold a candle to Kemper. That old saying, overused, couldn't hold a candle, I looked up its origin recently, from back when a shaky apprentice would be required to hold a candle for their master to illuminate the workspace and fail to do a good job of it. That's how I see Bowman next to Kemper, in a garage over a corpse, Kemper whispering what to do next, and John Bowman accidentally lighting the body on fire. Big John, to put it plainly, was a dope, and it shouldn't have been hard to see what he was up to, but the system was somehow blind to old Bottles, and the big brute managed to jealously kill for far too long, before finally turning those thick, murderous lenses around under the hot Antiguan spotlight to burn himself. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. The Control Freak. John Earl Bowman was born October 4th of 1941 and enjoyed a fairly unremarkable upbringing as far as future serial killers go, growing up in the outskirts of Chicago, Illinois. His father was a railroader and his mother a bookkeeper. John had two older sisters and a brother who had died as an infant. Besides this small amount of information, I can only share that John was a big kid who grew into a big man. We could speculate that he may have been doted on by his mother, being the baby of the family and her one surviving son. A sense of entitlement was born somewhere, and I feel that's a pretty sharp guess I'm having there. John was seen as polite and easygoing by those who barely knew him. He was just the opposite to those who truly knew him, a control freak who wanted everything to be done his way. Two tours of Vietnam as a Marine infantryman certainly contributed to John Bowman's rigid nature. The Vietnam War had a way of normalizing death, murder, and by the time John got home from Nam, whatever his childhood had twisted in him, Nam had easily snapped. Bowman, a bear of a man with an unusually high voice, was teased with the nickname Bottles, as I mentioned, because of his thick glasses. But that high voice on such a big man never helps. Perhaps the nickname Bottles also had something to do with the words that would whistle from his lips, like the sound made from blowing lightly across a bottle. Speaking of lightly blown, John was married to a woman named Gertrude, and it was messed up because Trudy, as her friends knew her, was cheating on John for much of their early marriage, and that inspired my lightly blown joke. He didn't get much attention, if you get my drift. My message in a bottle. It wasn't always this way. For John and Gertrude, they had married in 1964 while in their mid-20s and had three girls together, which indicates probably a few blowjobs, definitely some sex. By 1970, however, things had grown stale, and Trudy found herself in the arms of another man, Dean Pence. Dean was supposed to be John Bowman's best friend. The two had almost identical career and family situations. Dean and John were both cops, both married with young daughters, both from the Chicago area, living in bungalows just outside the city. They were both having sex with the same woman. That was an issue. That last one. I'm not here to shame Gertrude. John Bowman was an insufferable, overgrown baby of a man who wouldn't have been easy to live with, and I don't blame her for the affair with Dean Pence, who was also married. It's shitty what Dean and Trudy were up to, but everything got so much more messy and shittier than it needed to be when Gertrude told John, her husband, that she had been having an affair with his best friend Dean. And I'm going to go a little bit off the path here and say that I'm not sure why she did that. It seems that this news of the affair would ruin two families, and this news maybe should have stayed and died between Dean and Trudy. But instead, Dean and Trudy died. John was having a tough time when his wife and mother of his kids dumped this load of shit on him. John had recently been fired as a police officer for stealing snow tires from a town service station with his cruiser. That was stupid, but as I've tried to convey, John was a little stupid. He just did what he wanted, kind of like Dean, his best friend, and fucking his wife. But maybe that's why they were such good friends. They were both kind of stupid. His buddy Dean, meanwhile, had gone on to promotions within the police department and moved into the position of banging John's wife, apparently. John Bowman had been betrayed while working long shifts as a security guard following his slip and fall from grace, even with snow tires. John eventually became an electrician before securing a respectable career with aerospace conglomerate Honeywell. Hold on, maybe he wasn't so stupid after all. You know, you can be two things at once. You can be brilliant and stupid. Look at many of the people that we look up to these days. I think John Bottles Bowman was just compulsive, jealous. Oh, and a control freak. July 26, 1970. On the back road surrounding Preswick Country Club and Golf Course in the village of Frankfort, Illinois, Will County. A couple out for a Sunday drive come across a cop car, parked in a way on the side of the dirt road that makes them extremely uncomfortable. So they speed off, tires kicking up dust, shading the scene from revealing any more to us. There are some scenes in life that just don't inspire one to stick around and figure out what the heck is going on. And this one, an empty cop car with its doors open on the side of a dirt road, is one of them. The couple, they're in the year 1970, remember, so they either need to avoid getting involved in this situation or find a house to call for help at. They're an old white couple, so they don't want any trouble, and they choose the latter. Sergeant Dean Frederick Pence, 32 years old, a father and a husband with two young daughters, a best friend named John Bowman, John Bowman's wife being his mistress, a secret maybe none of us should have known, is soon discovered by responding officers in a ditch near his abandoned squad car. Dean Pence had been off duty, so he was dressed casually in a t-shirt and shorts. He had been shot four times with a .38 cal revolver, two in the chest, one in the arm, one in the face. He probably took the first in the arm, two in the chest, and was finished off. The location of his homicide turned out to be only 5 miles from his home. Clearly, Dean had come out here to meet someone before dying in the reeds. Sergeant Dean Pence was well-liked by all. He had been involved in working with troubled youth, supporting local athletic programs to keep teens off the streets and out of gangs in Chicago. Initially, it was thought that Dean had been murdered for reasons to do with his inner city activities. Young black men known to Dean were quickly questioned. It's a good thing for them that they weren't Sunday drivers or members of the country club. None of these young men could be placed at the typically tranquil murder scene of the country back road that night, that day, the day before. They were all in the inner city, believe it or not, not just hanging out outside a golf course. Let's talk a little bit about that scene. Two sets of tire tracks were focused upon as having been on the road along with Dean's cruiser that morning or night previous. One set of tracks belonged to the Sunday drivers. Another set eventually would be matched to the vehicle of John Bowman. And there's a third there, actually being the tracks of the cop car of Dean Pence. I share all this just to save us a little time. I could go much further into that, but these are the basics. So John Bowman, our big bottles brute, he became a suspect when his wife told investigators that she had recently informed John of her affair with the now deceased Dean. I'm sure Dean's wife appreciated this news in the midst of dealing with her husband's untimely death. Something to consider in life. What will be uncovered about you should you be moped by a truck this afternoon, or like with Dean, invited to talk to your best friend on a back road, then killed by him? Always wear clean underwear. Consider that. And consider this. Try to keep your affairs in order, especially that one with Gertrude. And that sounds crude. That sounds like Gertrude shouldn't have spoken up. I mean, I guess she should have. What I'm trying to say is that if you're doing anything nasty in your life, you think that you're going to be able to overcome it at some point, move on from it, heal it. You might not be able to. Something could happen, and who you are, who you're remembered as, what your legacy is, will be what you've left. So clean it up as quickly as you can. Before John was ratted out by his wife, Trudy, who had already been busy ratting out her part-time lover, Dean, the investigation had been focused on the absence of Sergeant Dean Pence's service weapon, a .38 revolver. As I mentioned, Dean had been shot down, then finished off with a blast to the face. I have a joke there that I'm not going to tell. He was finished off in the face with .38 cal bullets. And the thought was that Dean had met one of his inner city youths out here. Some believed he was attempting to break up a drug ring while doing undercover work and had his gun taken from him, then was killed with it. Dean was dressed in civilian clothing, but I think the cop car he was in would have tipped the bad guys off, so this can't be taken seriously, this idea. These theories were barely being pieced together when the discovery of Dean's service weapon in his locker at the precinct caused them to completely fall apart. How could he be shot with his own service weapon when his service weapon is in a locker? So, someone with a history of having possession of a cop-style revolver, perhaps a former cop like John Bowman, whose wife had told investigators of her affair with Sergeant Dean Pence, and then the tire tracks were matched to John's vehicle, and then John behaved like a big, sad, bad teddy bear upon questioning, someone like Old Bottles surely fit the bill here, right? John Bowman admitted to having met up with Dean on the Will County back road. He claimed that Dean wanted him there for backup, as he was to meet a third party out there for some unknown reason. John, remember, was no longer a cop at this time. It seemed more likely him and Dean met up to discuss the fact that Dean had been banging his wife, and was there any way to keep this affair from ruining Dean's own marriage too? Maybe that was the situation, but it didn't ruin John's marriage. He and Trudy would stay married for the next 14 years, in fact. The only marriage it ruined was Dean's, because he fucking died. This fact that Dean was now gone and that John's wife had told him he had been being cucked in the background here, this situation for a control freak like John Bowman, it set everything just right for him. John, like his wife, confessed to her about killing John. She would say this later. She confessed to him about cheating on John with Dean, and John confessed to his wife of killing Dean. And the police were like, well, okay, that sounds about right. But in the end, John wasn't even indicted due to there being insufficient cause to arrest, which seems crazy to me, and I'm sure to you. It feels like one of those small town incidents that slipped through the cracks because the small town didn't want the press or the hassle. It was the 70s, man. Sergeant Dean Pence's death remains unsolved to this day. John Bowman got out of this simply by saying, I have no idea what happened, after saying I know exactly what happened, and everyone was fine just to let sleeping dogs lie. Apologies to Dean Pence. I don't mean to call him a dog, but like I said earlier, whatever you were, whatever secrets you hold, if they're going to come out in the open, you didn't handle them, that's who you are now. It's very important. And I know it sounds like I'm talking to myself about something. No, I cleaned up my messes a long time ago. I'm ready to die. John's wife, 37-year-old Gertrude Trudy Bowman, worked as a realtor and at a town drugstore over the next decade and a half after Dean Pence's murder, his unsolved murder. She stayed married to John, as I mentioned. I guess John improved as a husband after likely murdering Dean. Either that or Trudy decided it best not to piss John off with a divorce, seeing as how he can get away with murder, apparently, in this town. Trudy took the lead in raising their three girls, but once that duty began to diminish, she maybe found herself interested once again in her own happiness. I heard a piece of wisdom when I was a teenager, and I never forgot it. It was shared to me by a man who hated women. He'd been divorced three times. And it's a piece, I called it wisdom. It was just a piece of bestowed wisdom as he was trying to put it to me. And again, I never forgot it. Here it is, quote, a man will give up his happiness for the sake of his family. A woman will give up her family for the sake of her happiness, end quote. And I'm just sharing what an unhappy man told me once. I remembered it because it struck me so hard because he really believed that. And it seemed like a warning he was trying to give me. But as I went through my life, I realized, no, I mean, just don't be an asshole. There were times when I thought he was right. Thankfully, today, I'm personally in a situation where that line of thinking doesn't apply to my life. And hey, do I need to say that that so-called wisdom could be turned around the other way? You know, that's the thing with such thinking. Too many of us believe our personal experiences to be the truth. It's just our truth, our own experience. There are countless truths and even more lies. Anyways, so Trudy, she decides that she wants to become a full-time career woman. She tells John that she appreciates the time they've spent together raising kids and having this marriage that is somewhat of a sham by this point. But at this juncture, she prefers to move on in life as a single woman. She hopes he will understand. Please don't kill me, John. John says, I'm not going to kill you, Trudy. It'll all work out. Don't worry, Gertrude. Let's try to work this out for a bit. Maybe do one more camping trip with the girls this summer first. See how we feel afterwards. Please, Trudy, for the girls. This is how I imagined things went. The control freak, the type of person who is a control freak. When the blame game's up and their backs are against the wall, the control freak will do the only thing they can to regroup and regain control. By time. April 21st, 1984, a Saturday. 8:30 a.m., the Bowman home, now located in Madison, Illinois, is on fire. John Bowman stands out front, towering over the women of his neighborhood who work to console him. The fire department works to put out the flames, largely centered around the home's attached garage. John is repeating over and over in his high, squeaky voice that Trudy's inside. Soon investigators will be speaking to John Bowman, a bear of a man, bearded, bespectacled, and bereft. What's the story this time, John?
Well, I'll tell you if you just give me a moment to collect my thoughts.
John shares that he and Trudy have been sorting through their camping gear, getting things prepared for an upcoming summer camping trip with the girls. Trudy, sitting on a blanket in the garage, had picked up a coffee cup that contained gas in it from a previous camping trip. The cup had been used to accelerate their campfires, this little cup of gas. And Trudy, forgetting this, she'd opened the lid of the coffee cup and gas had sloshed on her. When she got up from the blanket, which she was dribbling gasoline on as well. She then tripped on a portable camp stove and somehow accidentally turned it on, which immediately lit her clothes on fire. John says he then tried to help her, but the blanket he might have used to snuff her out had gas on it, like I mentioned, and it was a flame as well. Everything just happened so fast, and Trudy, in her panic, had quickly run around the garage and turned the garage into a well-stoked oven in no time. She'd run around lighting boxes and junk on fire in her panic. The whole garage soon went up in flames, and John was forced to flee. The story at first seems fairly plausible. It's quite detailed, quite controlled in its delivery. And either it actually happened or John Bowman had spent some time thinking it up, of course. The autopsy of Trudy uncovers that the poor woman had not breathed in much smoke. Not as much as a distraught woman on fire running around a garage normally would, that is. There was trauma to Trudy's neck, bruising which looked suspiciously like strangulation marks to the coroner. John Bowman, 42, is arrested for murder as a result. The coroner deduced that Gertrude Bowman had been strangled to near death, then doused in gas and lit on fire. September 9th, 1985. John Bowman's trial begins. The prosecution is restricted from sharing John's past as a main suspect in the killing of a police officer, Dean Pence, who had been having an affair with John's now dead wife. The defense claims that the strangulation marks are actually bruising from Trudy running her neck into a shelf of the garage. This action is remarkably remembered by John Bowman when he hears of the discovered bruising on the neck. How the hell her neck had enough flesh on it to determine bruising is beyond me, is beyond John Bowman. He didn't see that one coming. I've no doubt that surprised him. But a control freak knows how to think on their feet. The story comes to him instantly in the interrogation room, helping his case tremendously. The story of her running into a shelf on the wall that was at neck level, which in fact there was a shelf there that could have been what she ran into to cause the bruising on her neck. And his defense team brings in their own coroner at this point, who had only looked at photos of Trudy Bowman's corpse and the charred crime scene. He hadn't been there. This coroner that was hired by the defense shares that, yes, Gertrude's carbon monoxide levels may have been low, but still high enough were the CO levels to indicate she'd breathed in some smoke. The testimony of this random coroner that it couldn't be ruled out, the claimed accidental nature of the event by John Bowman, is taken heavily into consideration. When the trial is over, one where the prosecution was overmatched by the manipulative tactics of the defense and John, a jury of 8 women and 4 men deliberate for 4.5 hours, and in the end, the jury felt that there was too much reasonable doubt to ignore. John Bowman is found not guilty in the death of his wife and is left to collect on his wife's accidental death insurance. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. This, in 1985, means that John's kind of rich. John's defense lawyer was later caught paying off witnesses. It's likely he paid the coroner in John's case to go against the testimony of the prime coroner, though this was never proven, and the defense lawyer being caught paying off witnesses was in other cases. It seems that John sure knew how to pick him, though, his defense team, and it seems that he sure knew how to pick him off for the control freak murder. 2 of them. You know, this seemed to be a simple thing for him, a tool he could use to regain control when all would be lost for just about anyone else in his past situations of someone going out of his control. Rosetta Stone, everybody. Rosetta Stone is a leading language learning program available on desktop and mobile, designed to fully immerse you in your chosen language for a more natural and effective learning experience. I use Rosetta Stone, and my favorite aspect of Rosetta Stone is how you can learn faster, retain longer. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally. It helps you think and communicate with confidence. There's no English translation, so you truly learn how to speak, listen, and think in your chosen language. They have an intuitive learning process. You start with words, you build to phrases, and you progress to full sentences. And it's designed for long-term retention, so what you learn sticks with you. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. 6 years later, 1991, John meets a new love, 51-year-old Valerie Joyce. Valerie, a manager at 3M, had worked her way up to her position over 30 years, going from an entry-level customer service position all the way to management at 3M. That's to say that Valerie was highly motivated and known to family and friends as an energetic and fun woman, also intelligent. Valerie was twice divorced with 4 grown children when she met John at a singles dance. I can't imagine John loping around at a singles dance. Valerie Joyce, she was a grandmother, and John was now a grandfather, so they had that in common. Valerie fell in love with John quickly. She would share that she couldn't resist those big, sad teddy bear eyes of his and was drawn to him. John quickly admits to Valerie his past that includes 2 murder accusations. He wants to get everything out in the open, and the reason for that is so that he can control it. Valerie believes John to have been innocent, as the courts too had decided, so you couldn't really blame her. After a quick courtship, the couple decide they don't want to waste any time, and they are married by February of 1991. The new couple have 7 kids and 6 grandchildren between them. That's a lot of people and opinions to control. When you include spouses and friends and all that, there's so many new people in his life now, and most of the family are suspicious of John. There's a lot of rumors about him. These people all talk, you know, and of the suspicious are his own children. So John, you know, he's described by his new wife as controlling eventually and whiny to her family. And it becomes obvious to old John Bottles that he's going to need Valerie to himself as much as possible if he's going to keep control of this new marriage. So he begins using his money, his inherited money too, and Valerie's money to go on extensive vacations. And this solves a few issues. Vacations give off the impression that a couple is well off and happy. Also, John can keep Valerie to himself on vacation. He can begin his work in tailoring her to his liking. But when Valerie proves too tough of a nut to mush into a malleable paste, John Bowman can also use the secluded vacations to hide some of those arguments that happen in that, which these arguments have really ramped up by the spring of 1995. He needs a way out, but can't lose face or be cleaved in half financially in divorce. Well, he could. That could happen to him. But John Bowman doesn't want it to happen to him. So he decides to do what he's always done. May 12th, 1995. The Bowmans head to the Caribbean for a few weeks vacation. Now 53-year-old John Bowman and 55-year-old Valerie Bowman impress fellow guests along with staff of the Royal Antiguan Hotel. John is the perfect gentleman, and Valerie seems quite pleased with her man. This is by design. This is John's control of the situation. The couple travel to Barbuda, then back to the hotel in Antigua. They are seen everywhere in the Caribbean enjoying themselves, up until the tragic event that struck just over 2 weeks into this extended vacation. Valerie falls off of the roof of the Royal Antiguan Hotel on May the 27th of 1995. She and John had been drinking before dinner and decided to go up a fire escape to the hotel's tiled rooftop and view the goats on the surrounding hillsides. This by John's account. Valerie had been on the roof and receiving a love note from John when she dropped it, went to grasp it, then stumbled off the edge looking for it, falling 100 feet to her death. A tough nut finally cracked. Initially, this story was on its way to being the only story, and maybe would have been believed as the previous 2 had. This one wouldn't be believed because there was an Antiguan resident. His name was Philbert Jackson, and he happened to be on an adjacent balcony at a sight from the couple on the rooftop, but the couple inside of him as he was using binoculars. Was Filbert glassing for chicks at the resort? Probably. To be fair, he could have been looking for goats too, but if I were Filbert, I'd be more interested in the butts and the boobs down below by the pool. I mean, I think Filbert, being a resident, had probably already seen the goats. Regardless of what Filbert was looking at, he ended up hearing a scream from the south side of the resort and turned his enhanced sight to the noise, catching in his view of the binoculars the moment Valerie found empty space off the edge of the building, then plummeted 99 feet, 8 stories, in less than 3 seconds. Valerie had fallen backwards. That would be an important detail later in the trial that soon comes. Antigua doesn't play around. John Bowman finds his life on the line. The penalty for murder in Antigua is death by hanging. He's in a prison called Her Majesty's Prison, waiting to know his fate. The two-story brick building is packed with prisoners, and John stands out in there. It's rough in there. He figured this wouldn't be his situation. Incarcerated in an archaic facility built in 1735, he knew conditions would be difficult should he be arrested, but John, claiming to be innocent, never dreamed they'd incarcerate an American for some reason, especially one who just watched his wife die so dramatically. Did they have no mercy on this barbaric island? What John was experiencing, for once, was a no-bullshit approach to justice the Antiguan authorities didn't believe for a second when they came upon the scene with John with his hands in his hair going, "Oh my God, my wife!" They didn't believe for a second that the husband may not be responsible for the fall. You see, John, even though he had his hands in his hair, in his eyes and in his speech, he didn't seem upset enough. He'd stood over his wife's destroyed body, and then he'd just kind of focus his attention on not her condition, but on pleading his case to the arriving authorities. He was just explaining himself, and the Antiguan authorities used common sense to quickly deduce that John Bowman was lying to them. He was more interested in pleading his innocence than he was in the condition of his wife. He was arrested on the spot, put in prison, and told to shut the fuck up and wait. Investigators speak to their witness, Filbert, in the meantime, and get everything they think they'll need from him. Filbert shares that when he yelled out upon witnessing Valerie Bowman go backwards off of the rooftop and drop like a screaming letter V, that John, hulking on the rooftop edge, saw Filbert and began putting on what looked to be an act to Filbert, throwing his hands to his head and pacing around, constantly looking back up at him, "Oh my God, there's a witness," before rushing down the fire escape to get to his wife. Valerie was found 14 feet out from the building, crushed obviously from the fall. John claimed that she slipped, but the distance from the building is indicative of the victim having been pushed. The authorities let John dig his own hole before letting him know this. John tells them that their relationship, his and Valerie's, have been great. And he says, "You know, ask the hotel staff, ask the cab drivers. Everyone saw us having a good time." And the authorities do. But they also ask the family and friends of John and Valerie what the relationship was like. And they share that John was a control freak and that he'd probably killed his best friend and his ex-wife. This knowledge in mind, they hear John out, uncomfortable as John, in his ill-fitting prison garb. He's scared to be about the only white guy there. He's unimposing somehow, despite his size. It might have something to do with his high voice and his thick glasses. They have nothing to do with helping him in this situation. They're a massive hindrance. John explains that Val had been drinking all that day of her death and that she had seemed depressed. Authorities have already learned from family that Val was a cheerful, energetic woman who drank very little. John shares that he wrote Valerie love notes on Hallmark cards, 2 Hallmark cards that said, "Love, John," and he put one on the bed and then he kept another one in his pocket. On the day of Valerie's tragic end, John convinced her to go up to the roof together after first finding the one love note, and he's like in his head, "Oh, I got 2 love notes. She doesn't know I got 2 Hallmark cards that say love John on them. She's going to fucking lose it when I give her the second one on the rooftop." And he says they go up there to look for goats on the roof in the distance. while he plans on popping the second Hallmark card. And investigators have learned from family by this point that Val was terrified of heights. That's important to mention. He's pretty fucked here. Anyways, here is exactly John's story in his words. Quote,
"We walked up the stairs side by side, or maybe I was one step ahead. We were holding hands. When we reached the tiled area of the roof, we stepped out on the tiles, and I think we glanced out over the hills to look for the goats. It was a very short time before I pulled the card from my pocket, and I started to hand it to Valerie. She reached for it, and I think it hit the side of her hand, and it fell. It didn't fall straight down. It kind of fell at an angle, maybe a foot and a half in front of us. And we both started to pick it up, and, well, in order to pick it up, you had to take a short step, but it was not right at our feet. And as she went forward on her foot, the other one was slightly at the edge of the other foot. Or maybe she didn't pick her foot up. I don't know. Or maybe it didn't slide very well. Valerie was wearing slippers. While her body was going forward, though, her foot did not go far enough. So I think she lost her balance and she stumbled forward. She took a step or two in trying to regain her balance and she just went right off the roof."
End quote. Investigators go up to the rooftop and look for the Hallmark card. They can't find it. When they tell John this, he suddenly remembers that, oh shit, it's in my pocket. It's in the pocket of my shorts in a plastic bag. The investigators recover John's clothing from the prison intake area. And yes, there is a Hallmark card in his pocket with a little note written in it that one might write to their wife on Valentine's Day. You know, something like, "Love, John," after someone else wrote the whole fucking message inside the card. Cards are so stupid to me. I would never give somebody a card. I might write them a letter, but I never give somebody a card. Happy birthday to the fucking, most fabulous guy in town. Love your lover, Jack. No, that's not how I do it. So there's a question here. Besides all my silliness, we have to think about this. He picked up a card, and I said plastic bag. It's the plastic sleeve that the cards come in. It's not a plastic bag. It's a plastic sleeve. I misspoke. And it's in the plastic sleeve. And yes, it has a message inside of it, but he's like such a control freak. He likes things his way. He puts it back in the plastic sleeve thinking that that's, I don't know, look at it. It's brand new. Clearly I bought it. The question is, why would he pick up the card? And why did he still have the plastic on him and put it back in the sleeve? Or did he deliver it to her in the sleeve? Okay, then maybe that's what happened. That's why it was so slippery. Oh, I'm just getting this on the fly. Okay, John, maybe you are innocent here. But I mean, why did he pick the card up at all, plastic sleeve or not, after watching his wife fall off an 8-story rooftop to her death? Why did he think, oh shit, I better get that card in case she's still alive down there? I looked up some Antiguan slang to get an idea of what the locals and cops would have thought of John and how the prisoners would have been speaking to him while he was in prison there. Let me try out some of these, maybe bring us closer to the culture and the situation. Let's immerse a little bit. What a fuck, you mother skunt, bad boy, forehead, me rasshole. Wagwana, me partner. You know how far move me na big friend and so why. You manty man, skunt, rascal. All right. So, you know, that's what he's dealing with. And I just think it's really cool, that Antiguan slang, don't you? I learned some of that because there was a time in my mid-20s when I thought I was going to be raising an Antiguan child. You see, my girlfriend at the time went on a girls' trip to Antigua. This is a true story. And came back pregnant, which was exciting for me. I was like, wow, I'm going to be a dad. Oh, this is so awesome, babe. And the kid's going to be exotic. You say you got knocked up in Antigua. So we're going to have an Antiguan child. Oh my God, that's so neat. But then when my girlfriend said that she was going to marry the Rasta man who knocked her up so that he could become a Canadian, I was a little bummed, but I understood. You know, I started to get it. And I thought, you know, I'll pick up a little bit of patois, whatever they call it, just in case that doesn't work out. But it did work out for them. And I lost my bed and my couch and my cat. And I had to pay full rent at the building we were staying at together suddenly. But that Antiguan slang I learned in the short time where I thought I was going to be a dad to a half Antiguan kid, it sure came in handy here, didn't it? Everything happens for a reason, I guess. All right, so Johnny Bottles, he's in a bad way with the Antiguans. They're not putting up with his shit. They see through him. At trial, he tries to defend himself somewhat, speaking directly to the jurors, which is allowed in Antiguan courts. The defendant can just ramble at the jury and win them over whenever they want. They can win them over or doom themselves. That's kind of the point. And John, as you might guess, pretty much lays out the rope to hang himself with in his attempt to win over the jury. The jury and the judge make up their minds based on the evidence and John Bowman's reaction to that evidence. John claimed a face-first fall by Valerie chasing a love note. Philbert, with his binoculars, saw her go backwards. This was backed up by the fact that Valerie landed on her back. And you might think that she could twist in the air or whatever, and there's a few other ideas here, but she fell in, I think it was 2.64 seconds all the way to the ground. So you fall off that roof on your back. You're landing on your back. Valerie is found 14 feet out from the building, as I mentioned, and fall experts testified that Valerie had to have been pushed. John changes his story upon hearing resort worker testimony that they'd heard a bang in the fire escape. This was likely John starting to run down the stairs, but John suddenly claims when he hears about her being 14 feet out and she had to be pushed, he claims that, wait, Val hit the fire escape and it spun her out from the building. I forgot about that part. If you couldn't understand his speech there, he said that she hit the fire escape and it spun her out from the building. And then he goes so far as to say that he now remembers, she said, honey? As he reached down to pick up the letter and put it in his pocket, she fell and she said, honey? And he ran over and he saw her doink off the fire escape, causing her to bounce out. This addition of the letter being picked up to cover the odd detail of that letter being in his pocket, something the prosecution had mentioned, it causes the juror's face to screw as it already has screwed our faces up, I'm sure. Mine's been screwed up this whole time. And I'm not even confused. But John is pretty good at this adjusting his story thing. That wrinkle of the fire escape, doink, seemingly backed up by the workers hearing a bang outside, would make sense to a reasonable doubt-seeking jury that he had dealt with in the past. But these Antiguans are more about a gut feeling. They're more about the truth, the raw truth, what they see, you know, and about what they feel about the accused. That shift of John's story makes sense on paper. But the shift in the story itself, in reality, it does not make sense. Why did it take John until mid-trial, after getting an idea of the prosecution's angle and gaining information, why did it take till that moment to change that story? Well, as the jury deduces, it's because John's a rasclat mudskunt. Valerie had 19 injuries, all devastating, including a lacerated heart. Her fall had been a horrific way to go, and if the jury were to believe Philbert, the last thing she saw was John's face. And she didn't say honey as she fell. She screamed, her heart broken, then literally broken, along with her body. Here's another damning detail. Valerie's kids, after learning of their mother's death, tried to get into her and John's house, but the locks had been changed. Before John left for vacation, he arranged for a locksmith to change the locks. John claims the reason to be that Valerie lost her keys. But guess whose keys the locksmith used to get in the house to change the locks? Valerie's keys that he left near the door after he was done. And that's sloppy work, John Bowman. Even sloppier, he'd taken out a $200,000 accidental death insurance on Valerie before the trip. And this is reminiscent of his ex-wife, too. But the dumbest thing, the sloppiest thing John did was to change his hotel room to a single room for the days following Valerie's fall. He did this change to a larger room to a smaller single room. He made this change with the hotel before the fall happened, knowing she'd be dead and just trying to save a few bucks in the last days of his trip. So I think I was having some trouble earlier wondering whether or not he was intelligent or not. I already said it, like, you can be intelligent in your work, you can be book smart, but street smart, he is not. The jury, as if they needed any more reason, in this highly publicized case, and one of the most infamous in Antiguan history, the jury, on April 4th of 1995, much to the delight of the courtroom and a crowd outside chanting for death, decides John Bowman should hang. And John agrees. After a failed appeal on May 31st, 1995, John Bowman tied his bed sheets together, secured one end to the bars of a high window, and managed to do it himself. His way. The control freak. And that'll do it. Today is the 8-year anniversary of Dark Topic, so to celebrate, I think I got a new logo on here. If you don't see it, you'll see it soon. I want to thank Fred Diedrich, Dead Rick, of Iron Bean Coffee Company for creating it. Check out Iron Bean Coffee Company for all your coffee needs. Lots of pleasant surprises to come with Dark Topic. 8 pleasant surprises to mark the 8-year... I think I got 3 surprises. The first being the new logo. For those who like the old one, it'll be available in merch form. That's surprise number 2, which isn't ready yet. My store, my website's not quite ready yet, but there will be merch in March. And surprise number 3, I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant, guys. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not pregnant. I got a vasectomy. Surprise number 3 will reveal itself naturally, and it begins with this episode. For ad-free episodes, visit patreon.com/darktopic. There you'll get Dark Topic Plus. That's more Dark Topic. You get Brutal with myself and Ken Chungus doing the most brutal cases that we possibly can, delivered in brutal fashion. And you'll get Jack Luna's Dark Fiction, as well as more. I kind of live on Patreon. For Apple listeners, try Dark Topic Plus. You can get a 3-day trial, and that will unlock these 2 offerings, Dark Topic Plus and Brutal. Thank you for listening for all 8 years, or even 8 days. I've been a tough act to follow, and I don't think that's how that saying works. What I'm trying to say is I've been all over the place. If you look back at the history of Dark Topic, you'll see it says I started in 2020. I actually started in late 2016. I started writing in 2016. I released my first episode on February 13th of 2017, just before Valentine's Day. And I just really appreciate you all sticking with me. All the places I've been, you know, and there's so many past listeners that don't know that I'm still doing this thing based on some of the messages I get. I had a person leave a bad review, speaking of messages, and it was based on me bitching about Disney in my last episode. I wasn't really bitching, I was trying to be honest. And they were saying how they helped me pay for that Disney trip and how they got rid of their subscription to me because it was like they didn't want to support a guy who didn't appreciate the money that I was getting. And I gotta say something about that. It's a transaction. These extras that I talk about all the time, if you want a more Dark Topic, there's a transaction there. You know, it's not a charity. You can pay for more for exclusive content, or you don't have to. You know, your $10 or your $13, your $5, your $25, it gets you more Dark Topic. It doesn't go to a Disney fund for Jack. The Disney fund is my 8 years of podcasting, and that was my first real vacation. I do appreciate you all being here. I don't want to bitch about that too much, but I get that sometimes. It's like, oh, I'm just paying for your... I feel like I'm paying for an addict's addiction. It's like, well, no, you're just paying for extra content, or you're listening to a podcast. I mean, I'm fucking putting in work here. This isn't a GoFundMe. Anyways, I do appreciate being here, you know, and I appreciate you listening. I'm a true crime podcaster, not a GoFundMe. It's my job. And for anyone who thinks for a second that I'm privileged, ask somebody who knows about where I'm coming from, or just listen to the last 8 years of Dark Topic wherever you can find them. Hey, big love to you. On a positive note, I'm very, very committed to Dark Topic this year. There's a lot of things I had going on the side that I decided on that Disney trip. I was like, you know what? Forget them. You need to be doing Dark Topic as frequently as you possibly can. And you know what? I will reveal the third surprise. I plan on doing Dark Topic weekly. From this moment forward, at least I'm going to really try. So you will see Dark Topic coming out. And I'm aiming for Thursdays. Dark Topic Thursdays. DT Thursdays. Look forward to it. Eyes cocked, doors locked, stay paranoid. I'll talk at you real soon. Thank you.